Have you ever felt like you've got more in the tank and you know that there's more potential in you, especially in business? Jack came to set the standard and he ended up tripling his business within a couple of months. He has an email marketing company. Some of the tools and the tactics and the mindsets that we teach every 2 to 3 weeks in a free mindset webinar. This is an invite to you to come to that webinar. Just click the link below. It's the first link in the description and I'd love to see you guys there. Can't wait.
G'day guys, this is a podcast episode that you do not want to miss. So today I have on Dr. Stephen Hussey, who is, he's an author, he's written a couple of different books, and he is one of the like leading people that I know of who talk about, you know, heart disease, health, and having a proactive approach to absolutely crushing and living life at your best. And this podcast is ridiculous. There are so many practical tools here and tips and advice in terms of improving your heart health, improving your metabolic function, and in terms of like literally optimizing your life and some tools of and some education and awareness of what you can actually do within your house, within your life, with the food that you eat and everything that you can do to make sure that you are healthy as and that you're living a life of being extremely healthy. So please listen to this podcast the whole way through. Guys, if you do get any value from this podcast and you find them beneficial or helpful, please, it would mean the absolute world to me if you could just really quickly share this podcast onto your story. If you just quickly click the link, click the little square box with the arrow and put it onto your story. Like, subscribe, and then also if you really like value this stuff, it means a lot because what essentially my goal is to like, we just recently, this podcast has got like number 180 in the Australian health and fitness podcast category. And we want to get this podcast up to number one. And the only way that that's going to happen is if we work together. And if you guys jump onto, if you listen on Apple, and you leave a review and put a review on there, that helps us increase this stuff, increase the podcast so that we have more people listening and that they're getting this good information. They're getting like more self-aware and they're taking another step closer to living the best version of themselves and their lives as best as possible. And you guys are directly contributing to that. If you're sharing, liking, subscribing and leaving reviews, that would mean the absolute world to me, the world to the podcast. It would mean the world to the podcast guests and for all the people who are listening. Also, at the moment, I have some coaching available. As you might have heard from the start, I have part-time, full-time and some community coaching, which I'm starting up. If you're interested, just go to coreybatwell.com and follow the prompts in there and we can have a chat and we can talk about some of the things that we have on offer. Also, in terms of everything that we've learned, like in this actual podcast, what we go through and go ahead with is that I have a recipe ebook, which essentially on my articles on my website, I spend a lot of time researching the best ingredients, the most healthy ingredients to use. And then I put them into an ebook so that they're extremely tasty. And it's got all the sequences to how to actually cook and make them tasty and that they're extremely healthy for you, especially in terms of like, there's hacks in there for meal prep. There's bone broth potions. I've got like all of these different, like I got fancy meals. I've got easy meals and just a lot of like real simple stuff, which is super tasty and super healthy. And like, you don't want to miss out on that recipe ebook. Like it's an absolute godsend. I highly recommend. And that'll be linked below as well. Same with all the Dr. Stephen stuff. All of his things will be linked below. And obviously guys, this podcast is sponsored by Aeternum Labs. And we get into some of the Aeternum Labs stuff in here. It's just a little secret. If you're listening to this, is one of the main things that we talked about in this podcast was the importance of health and oxidative stress and making sure that your body has enough antioxidants to like support itself is glutathione. And we have a glutathione product incoming. So stay tuned for that. We also have a whole bunch of awesome products on the Aeternum Labs website. You can go to eternumlabs.com.au. We have products. Well, basically the main mission for Aeternum Labs, right, is to help people like you, especially the entrepreneurial type people or people who want to be the best versions of themselves, is to support you guys as best as possible with the best products so that you can get, so that you can have the best energy and be extremely productive and be extremely proactive by using our supplements. And obviously glutathione is going to be one of those, but we have a whole range of lion's mane. We've got two products, Zen and Zone. We sell resveratrol and all the other good stuff on there. So you can go onto there and get those. And obviously you can use the code Corey to get yourself a 10% off discount, which is awesome. So again, guys, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Thank you for choosing to be the best version of yourself and for choosing to learn all of this really good stuff so you can apply it to yourself and live a really good, happy, healthy, and long life. It's just so good and so fantastic. And I couldn't recommend this podcast anymore. So again, if you like it, please share it and please leave a review. And without any further ado, guys, I hope you enjoy this podcast with Dr. Stephen Hussey, as I thought it was absolutely amazing and mind blowing. I'm literally going to send it to my parents after this because I'm like, you guys need to hear this. This is absolutely ridiculous. So yes, without any further ado, guys, please enjoy this podcast and I'll see you in the next one. G'day, Stephen. Thank you so much for jumping onto the show.
Yeah, no problem, man. Excited to be here.
Yeah. So what have you been working on recently? And just real quickly, what are some new things that you have learned recently that you have found has just been amazing?
What I've been working on is as we were talking a little bit before the podcast is I wrote this book about the heart and I originally self-published it and then publishers got word of it. And so I got picked up by a publisher. So now it's not available, but we're working to republish it through the publisher. So we're having to go through all like the editing and marketing and those kind of steps. So, I've been working on editing my book, which is, I admit sometimes frustrating because I've already written it. Now I got to go back and work on it again. But that's what I've been working on recently. And then, I guess sort of new, but it was kind of confirmed by a study that recently came out, was that I've always, been of the opinion that low cholesterol is not the best for us, or having really low cholesterol is not the best for us. But a study just came out maybe almost a month ago now, that showed that, the optimal levels of cholesterol, when you look at all cause mortality, like for total cholesterol, and I don't know what these numbers will be in whatever metrics they use in Australia, but if for the States, the total cholesterol between 200 and 250 and LDL cholesterol between 100 and 150, is where people had the lowest all-cause mortality. If people had levels at those numbers, and those are actually would be seen as higher than is what is desired by Western medicine. The cholesterol is not the enemy and it does a lot of good things in the body. And this study shows that when we have quote unquote elevated cholesterol, slightly elevated cholesterol, it's actually best for, preventing death from all causes.
Well, I'm going to go to my blood tests and just give them an absolute smack right now because mine say that they're a little bit elevated. I think we have the same, metrics, but what I was looking at mainly is like, for me personally, just when I was looking at it, just because I'm a little bit skeptical around the averages for cholesterol, I was just looking at the ratio, and I was like, "Well, if my ratio is all right, then I should be fine." Is that true? Or
you mean like the trig to HDL ratio?
Yep, of the HDL to LDL.
Yeah, well, HDL to LDL. Yeah, the ratio that one's there is important, but I'd say even more important than that is the triglyceride to HDL ratio.
Okay.
Because that one is one of the best, I guess, markers for what we call metabolic health, being metabolically flexible, being insulin sensitive. Those are all kind of the same thing. So that number, if you divide triglycerides by HDL, you want it to be like 1.5 or lower. And that's in the metrics that I use in the States. So people would have to convert it if they have different metrics. But that's one of the, I guess, if that number is good, that's one of the best predictors of not getting chronic disease in the future, whether it be cancer, heart disease, diabetes, whatever.
So looking at your triglyceride to HDL is probably a lot more important ratio than the HDL to LDL. And if your cholesterol is a little bit above what the standard is, that's a good thing.
Yeah, definitely a good thing.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, because so many people just like look at your cholesterol all the time. You're like, oh, I got to lower it. But that's just fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, there's a whole, big story, if you want to get into it, of why cholesterol is thought to be this bad thing. But it turns out it was some bad research. So we can get into that if you want to.
Yeah, I'd love to know why. I'd 100% love to know why, because there's so much going on with cholesterol, and there's like a lot of people that I know that are on like medicine for cholesterol. And obviously if you're looking at cholesterol and then blood pressure and trying to figure out the two between the both, it can also get confusing. So yeah, I'd love to know all about the,
So the whole idea started, first of all, like, you know, the turn of the 1900s, I guess, cardiology wasn't even really a profession. There was very few cardiologists. It just wasn't needed, you know. But then like in the 1950s, after World War II, heart disease, especially in America, started to grow in prevalence, and people wanted an answer to why that was. And so this one guy named Ansel Keys, who's a scientist at the University of Minnesota, he gave people an answer. So he basically looked at the data from a bunch of different countries, and the data from like how much heart disease they have to how much like saturated fat they eat and different types of foods they eat. And he found that there was a correlation between how much heart disease a country had and how much saturated fat they ate. But what we found out later was that there was data from 22 countries available at the time, and he used the 6. And then later he did another study. He used the 7 countries that gave him the correlation that he wanted to see. The foundation that saturated fat in the diet and higher levels of cholesterol cause heart disease came from that. And then later, maybe like 8 years later, there was 2 other scientists who redid that study with all the data from the 22 countries that was available and found there was no correlation whatsoever. And then interestingly, but you know, by that time the ship had sailed and the message was saturated fat's bad for you. Don't eat it, you know? And so that's stuck ever since. Now, the really curious thing is that there was a bunch of studies done. There was the Minnesota Coronary Survey. There was the Sydney Diet Heart study. There was a Helsinki Businessman study. There was a study in Norway that all tested pretty much the same thing. They all took people and they substituted saturated fat in their diet with unsaturated fat. And then they compared that to a control group where they didn't change the diet. And so they used like margarine or vegetable oils to substitute the saturated fat in the diet. And every single one of those studies showed that when they substituted the vegetable oils or the margarine, the unsaturated fat in the diet, that there was a higher risk of heart disease. More people died of heart disease, had heart attacks, things like that. And the interesting thing was that in the Minnesota Coronary Study, Ansel Keys, the guy who did that previous research, he was one of the lead authors on the study. But the study didn't turn out like they wanted it to. So his name was not on the study anymore. Like he was the lead author, the lead investigator, but he took his name off the study. And that study was finished in like the late, maybe 1973, I think it was. And it's when they finished that study. And it wasn't published until like 15 or 16 years later.
What?
And when they did publish it, it was published in like a small journal that no one really reads, rather than like the New England Journal of Medicine or something like that. So, and then this one guy went back and he asked one of the authors, like, why didn't you publish it? What happened? And they're like, we didn't like the result we got. So, you know, this
who
whole
do you
idea,
trust,
that's right. Yeah. This whole idea that saturated fat and animal foods and cholesterol in food and that kind of stuff is bad for us, was founded on bad science and then perpetuated, largely because there was a lot of industry backing in the idea, like, you know, grain, cereal companies, industry like that, you know, wanted this idea. They wanted to blame fat so that people would buy grains and sugars and things like that. So they put a lot of money into that. And then also, you know, the pharmaceutical companies, they see that, you know, cholesterol is high and we have a drug that can lower cholesterol. Yeah, we want this idea to be the mainstream idea so that people think they need to take medications so they get more medications and we can make more money, you know, like, and people kind of think that maybe that's just, you know, conspiracy or whatever, but it's just, all it is just capitalism, you know, people following the money and that's just the result of what happened, you know?
Yeah.
But the real important thing is to find the truth and to dig that up and then act accordingly.
Yeah. I always think that, like, I sort of have this thought when I think about like how this stuff got out, right? And you're like, oh my goodness, there's all this misinformation. It's misleading. We've been eating like this. We've been told to have this. This has been put here. And I always just kind of think like when it kind of comes down to it, at the time when the people made these decisions or published certain things, they were just like, we're doing what we think is best at that time, which kind of sucks when it's been deeply ingrained into us and conditioned for a long period of time. And now it's like, oh, coconut oil and grass-fed butter is really good for you. And your cholesterol should be a little bit higher. Like that's
That's right.
I can imagine so many people's belief systems just being like,
And, but you know, the bad thing, I guess the, cause yeah, I do. I believe you too. Like, I think that at the time people thought that that was what was best. They were doing what was best. They were finding the answers, you know? Unfortunately, what happens after that is when we feel like when people find out they were wrong, they don't necessarily admit it. There's too much to be lost, you know, as far as a big company goes. Right. And so like credibility is lost, money's lost, there could be lawsuits. And so people don't necessarily, and companies don't necessarily readily admit those mistakes.
Crazy. Like, why would they, to be honest?
Yeah.
What else have you been learning? What else is something new that you've just been like, whoa, that's fantastic?
New? I don't know. I recently read a book about how terrible the herbicide glyphosate is for us.
Which is what they spray on all plants and vegetables that get put into our supermarkets.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. So, and it's a, you know, it comes from a company that has a history of making DDT and Agent Orange. So you'd think that there'd be more stringent, you know, examination procedures before that's allowed to be, you know, the next product they come up with is allowed to be sprayed on things. But it's actually patented as a weed killer, as a antibiotic, and something else. I can't remember. It's patented as three things, but yeah, it's pretty pervasive in our environment these days because what it's an herbicide. So it's sprayed on plants and crops because, the crops are genetically modified to be resistant to this herbicide. And so then you can spray the herbicide all over the place and the plants don't die, but the weeds do. And then even if there's, plants that aren't genetically modified, like wheat, is largely not genetically modified. They still spray it on there at the end because it brings the plant to seed quicker. The ripens up quicker, so they get a higher yield. So even if there's like, even if you buy like non-GMO certified kind of things, they could still be contaminated with glyphosate because they like to spray it on things to increase the yield at the end of the year.
And what does glyphosate do like in your body? Do you know?
Yeah. Well, like in a plant, it kills the plant by interfering with, I believe it's the shikimate pathway, which basically disrupts the plant and then kills it. But in our body, you know, we don't have that pathway. We're not plants. Yep. However, glyphosate is just similar enough to glycine, which is an amino acid, that it substitutes for that in like a lot of biochemical processes in our body. And so that disrupts a lot of things. You know, the specifics I'm not as familiar with as the researcher who wrote that book, but like when you amino acids are the building blocks of, you know, our body, you know, and if you interfere with those things, it's going to cause a lot of issues. And people there's symptoms across the board that have been found to be linked with glyphosate.
Yeah. Crazy. So buy local organic vegetables.
Yeah. People. Yeah. Organic support. And, you know, and organic doesn't mean that it's absolutely 100% free of chemicals, but it's way less, you know, like things cross-pollinate, you know, things get sprayed and they come over, but you know, yeah, local is definitely important. And then organic is the best way to protect yourself and get the least amount of toxic exposure.
Yeah, true. Which is why I also find like, because of all these things and like we're constantly eating it, and there's a lot of people who are listening to this and myself guilty of as well, that you just have the occasion where you're like, yeah, but I'm not going to eat organic, like I can't today, I've got this on and I've got this done, and it's just like so readily accessible and easy to get the food from here or do something, which is why I think like supplements can be beautiful in terms of actually using supplements to like negate these things, and why they're so needed and why it's such a big industry. What do you think are like some of the supplements that you could use to protect yourself as best as possible and make sure that you have, you know, healthy as heart as possible.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I hear arguments from people that say, like, you know, we should get everything from diet. And fundamentally, I agree with that. But I also realize that we live in the modern world. And the modern world is full of toxins and people are way more stressed out. So why not, you know, up our resistance a little bit by using some supplements? And I think probably the number one, as far as like, you know, protecting yourself from toxins and things like that, is glutathione. You know, we need that. And so one thing you can do to boost your body's production of glutathione is using glycine, which is what we just talked about with the glyphosate, how that substitutes for glycine. But glycine has been shown in studies that when you use that, I mean, it's one of the building blocks of glutathione. So when you eat that, which is like connective tissue proteins, like collagen proteins and things, when you eat that, your glutathione production goes up. But then you could also just take straight glutathione. That would really help.
Yeah, for anyone who's listening, if you're following the Aeternum Labs journey at the moment, we've just come out with a glutathione product. And it's also really cool because I put glycine in my bone broth, and I have bone broth every morning, and I have it with lion's mane, glycine, glutamine, and a little bit of L-theanine. And I noticed that significant, like every single day that I have that mix of things, I significantly just like feel better for the entire day. So
yeah, I mean, it can be a game changer for people, especially if your liver's feeling a little sluggish, it's got a lot of toxins to deal with, and it's not making as much glutathione. You know, give your body a little boost, give it some help. But then the other thing, as far as detoxification, is sweating. That's huge. People don't realize it, but you know, just working up a sweat every day is going to release a lot of toxins in your sweat. So,
yeah, that's one thing that I was thinking to myself before I got a sauna, because when I lived in Adelaide, I had a sauna. I've moved to Queensland, and I don't have a sauna anymore. So I was like, damn, but there is some close by. But I even remember like thinking like, well, what does the body do in terms of being able to sweat? And it's like, well, obviously we have all these benefits when we are sweating, and that's our body's like heating procedure. And what do we do to heat? Like, we move. So when I go for like a really long walk, not just a small walk, but like a, you know, getting up to close to an hour every single day, or I go on like a hike, which is a little bit harder, or a slow jog, and immediately start sweating, or when I'm in the gym or I'm feeling sluggish, sometimes I literally feel like, my blood sugar, I don't know what it's doing right now. I feel like my body's got to detox or process something, and I feel a little bit, As soon as I'm in the gym and I get towards the end of the session where I really start sweating, or I go for a big walk and I'm towards the end of the walk and I start sweating, or I go for a jog and I'm at the end of a jog and I start sweating, immediately start feeling better. Like as if something's just been taken off from me.
Exactly. Yeah. So like usually our liver has to deal with all these toxins and everything. And no matter how hard you try, you can't avoid all the toxins in our modern world. So you're going to be exposed to them. But yeah, usually our liver has to deal with all those. But if we work up a sweat every day, we're giving our liver a huge break because we're releasing some of those toxins through the skin. So the liver doesn't have to deal with it. And so, people feel like you say, you just kind of feel bad or whatever, but like nausea, like one of the things I think of, you know, aside from gut stuff, is liver. If your liver is stressed, then nausea is one of the things you're going to feel, and you're just going to feel sluggish. And so, I mean, that's your main metabolizer right there. So if that's backed up or dealing with a lot of toxins, then it can definitely make you feel bad. So if you sweat them out every day, that gives your liver a huge break.
Crazy. What are some other tips or tools that you think people can use in terms of just being able to support their liver, support their heart, and make sure that
they're
optimized within their body?
Yeah, I think that we kind of touched on it a little bit with the trig-HDL ratio, but just being like metabolically flexible. So like as far as the heart and the liver goes, I mean, the liver is our main metabolizing organ, but the heart's really interesting and unique because it seems to, more than any of the other organs, have a preference for burning fatty acids and ketones. And it functions way better when it's doing that. And I think it even has mechanisms in place that that ensure that it gets kind of like, that it always has enough fatty acids to burn. One of those being that, just the way our fats are absorbed and packaged at first, they're packaged into chylomicrons. And then that goes into the lymphatic system, but because they're very big, So that's the only way they can really get in. But the lymphatic system pretty much drains straight into the heart. And then when it gets there, it has to go to the lungs, and then it comes back to the heart. But like when it comes out of the heart, the first place it goes is back to the heart tissue where it's supplying those fats. So it's like the heart gets first dibs on the fats, you know? And then also there's a, they discovered recently, I think the study was like a couple of years ago, that the heart has a, like a direct signaling pathway to fat cells. So basically whenever the heart feels like it doesn't have enough fatty acids to burn, it can signal the mobilization of fats from those fat cells, which is pretty interesting. And so, you know, there's interesting studies that show that, you know, when they put, like, even in the presence of glucose, in the heart tissue, when they put ketones or fatty acids in there, the glucose utilization goes down dramatically. So clearly the heart prefers those fuel sources. So you make those available and it stops using glucose, starts using the other ones. And I think there are reasons for that, as far as like protecting the heart metabolically, because when you burn fatty acids and or ketones, you make less oxidative stress. You get more ATP molecules from that, when you do that than when you're burning glucose. And so I think that if the heart is forced to burn more glucose than it wants to, which there's a situation where that can happen, then bad things can happen, like lactic acid buildup and that kind of stuff. Yeah, I mean, I think one hack for the heart is to make sure you're supplying it with enough fatty acids and ketones. You don't have to be like on a, you know, full blown ketogenic diet to do that. Yeah. Although that's one way to get ketones available. But just a whole foods, I'd say metabolically flexible type diet, I think will be enough to do that.
Dude, that's insane. So like, firstly, just to like recap on some of those, as you mentioned, like getting the heart into the position to utilize fatty acids and ketones, as you mentioned, the lymphatic system gets it going. So like to get the lymphatic system, jump on a trampoline or go for a walk. Preferably a longer one or like a light jog. That's going to get your lymphatic system absolutely pumping, which is then going to put your heart in a really good position to start burning fatty acids, which I'm assuming has something to do with lipolysis, get you into like a sort of fat burning state.
I mean, like in a ketogenic state, you know, like to make ketones, or like to burn fatty acids. Yeah. Like, so most of the body, you know, it burns, like if you eat a lot of carbohydrates, the body's going to burn those first. It's easier to burn them. You kind of, you know, burn through them pretty quickly. You know, so in order for most of the body to, you know, get into a state where it's burning primarily fatty acids and ketones, you have to restrict carbohydrates. And so that's what we would call a ketogenic diet, you know, where you restrict carbohydrates to probably less than like 20 or 30 grams of carbohydrate, and your body is forced to upregulate the mechanisms to burn fatty acids and then make ketones and burn them. So that's the traditional ketogenic side of things. The heart seems to be a little different, that even when glucose is present, it seems like I said, to have first dibs on these things to keep it burning more fatty acids and ketones. But that doesn't mean that there can't be a situation where the heart is forced to burn more glucose than it wants to. And it has to do with our stress response and our autonomic nervous system that can trigger that kind of stuff, because the heart's very connected to our emotional state and our stress response. But yeah, so like, you know, ketosis, I guess, and it is the state in which your body takes like fats and it takes a fatty acid and it makes a ketone from it. And ketones are interesting because, you know, if you have excess energy, like extra glucose, your body, the only thing you can do with that is store it. And it has to store it as fatty acids in fat cells. It could burn it too. But if there's extra, it'll store it. So with a ketone though, like you can take those extra fats, that extra energy you may have, convert them to ketones. And ketones are a form of fuel that can be wasted, which sounds like a bad thing. But in this case, it's a good thing because you're not storing it, which is why when people are going ketogenic diets, they can, you know, they pee out ketones or they breathe it out, or they sweat it out or something like that. And that's beneficial in the sense that it's going to help you avoid like a poor metabolic state where there's excess energy storage which will lead to insulin resistance and things like that. But I think that, you know, the making of ketones and the heart specifically, you know, has these mechanisms that encourage the making of ketones so that it has those as fuel source, so it doesn't have to burn glucose.
The body is just ever complex, just doesn't stop.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I don't think we'll ever fully understand it.
Oh, ever, man. It's so advanced.
Yeah.
What do you suggest then? Like, how do you, like, it's just as far as like a practical tools, if you're someone who's like, all right, cool, I understand maybe some of those points. I understand everything that Stephen just said. Like, awesome. If I want to make sure that I'm optimized with that and have a metabolically flexible diet, like, what are some things that I can start doing and trying?
Definitely. It's a good question. So there's all these diets out there, you know, like I would call them some of them dogmatic, you know, some of them restrictive. You know, there's vegan diets or vegetarian, there's carnivore diets now, there's ketogenic diets and Mediterranean and all this kind of stuff. And so people can get caught up in certain diets, and, you know, if it works for you, it works for you. And that's great. If you know, being strict and restricted on something keeps you, you know, eating what you want to eat, then that's great. But I think that at the end of the day, there's no perfect human diet. There never has been, and there probably never will be. So it's important not to be dogmatic about a certain diet and to listen to your body and figure out what diet works best for you. In general, though, I have a few key points, and that is that humans are not meant to consume unsaturated fatty acids in the amounts that we're consuming them. And that's mainly from vegetable oils, margarines, things like that. Vegetable oils, I mean like canola oil, corn oil, soy oil, safflower oil, that kind of stuff. Those are not human foods. We should not be eating those. And you got to be careful because they're added into a lot of food. So I think that's one. The two other culprits, I think, are processed grains and processed sugars. Those are very problematic because the vegetable oils, they like break our metabolism. Just the way that when they're burned in our cells, they do things that end up breaking our metabolism to a way that causes insulin resistance, which is the precursor to diabetes. And then the processed carbohydrates, processed sugars, processed grains, they just are fuel to the fire, you know, so they don't necessarily break the metabolism. They can fatigue it, but the vegetable oils break the metabolism and they just make it 10 times worse. So those are the three like major culprits. So if we're talking about what foods to avoid, those are the ones we want to get rid of in our diet. When I say processed grains, I pretty much mean all grains because there's no grain that's not processed. You know, you have to process grains to eat them.
Grains and vegetable oils, kick them out the door. Boom.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You're going to feel 10 times better. And then as far as like what to eat, the most important thing is to eat whole foods. You know, people talk about the macronutrients and all that stuff, which is important. And especially if you're like a athlete and you're looking for performance goals, like the macronutrients are very important, but for the average person just wanting to be healthy, I think just focus on eating whole foods, lower in carbohydrates. So that means like your carbohydrates should only, if they're coming from whole foods, it's going to be lower carbohydrate. You're going to be eating things like berries and maybe a sweet potato or some winter squashes, things like that, you know, whole food carbohydrates. But yeah, so whole foods, lower in carbohydrate. Most of your energy, I think, should come from animal fats. And then the last thing is prioritize protein. So make sure you're getting enough protein. That's huge. If you're getting enough protein, you're going to satiate yourself, which means you're going to eat less. And, you know, the number one predictor of longevity as we age is the maintenance of muscle mass. And to maintain muscle mass, you've got to get enough protein. And animal protein is very important there because, animal and plant proteins are not created equal. We can get, so like if something says there's a difference between like crude protein and then true utilizable protein. And like, you know, beans are said to have a lot of protein. However, it's only like 42% utilizable, you know, by us. Whereas like a steak is probably like 92% utilizable by us. And so if we're looking to get enough protein, the animal protein sources are going to be way better, way more bioavailable to us. And we talked about how the saturated fat is not the cause of heart disease already. So that takes care of that. But it's important to get like you know, what I recommend is about, you know, at least 1 gram of protein per kilogram of body weight per day. And that is just to maintain the muscle mass you have right now. If you want to increase that to muscle mass, you have to eat more.
Yeah. And do other things like train or
yeah, like actually work out. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Or get into the sauna or something, get the meat chop proteins, make sure that,
yeah.
That, yeah, is, yeah. that you're staying in there. Man, that is like crazy, but so simple. And I do think as well that not all animal protein is created equal as well. Like depending on like how the animal's raised, where it comes from, being in Australia, like we're quite blessed. Like literally everything's pretty much, if you look at it, it's like all grass fed. And then you look at the steak and it's like, oh, we've been grain fed for 100 days, like to make it look good. It's like, just keep it grass fed. Come on, guys. But, what do you think would be if someone was to like start eating like more protein, what do you think would be like the best animal sources?
I mean, I think red meat's probably the best and the most, I think, evolutionary consistent with humans, you know, is red meat. And it's, to me, I like it because it has the right ratios of everything, especially if it's grass fed. So, it's going to have a better ratio of fatty acids if it's grass fed. But it has a good ratio of fats to protein, right? Of energy to nutrients. And that's important. So like, you know, chicken is fine too, but it's a lot less fat. So, and it's way more nutrients. So like way more protein, which is fine, but you just want to make sure you get the energy source too. So when I think of like an ideal food, I think of like a ribeye steak, because it satisfies all the things. It gets the protein. There's tons of nutrients. People don't understand because everybody talks about like kale and other things, you know, being nutrient dense, but a steak is incredibly nutrient dense. And it's got the energy source. It's got the fat with it and it's in the right ratios when you eat it, when you eat the whole, you know, as a whole food, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I just love to extract this from you just real quickly. It's like, what did you like, if you had like an ideal day for like stuff to do for someone, if they're like, all right, if I wanted to tick off everything in the day and just make sure like this day was perfect, like what would you recommend someone to do? And that's also including other things in terms of like exercise or what not to use or what to actually use and do within like a day that you think would be really good.
Yeah. So like I'll probably list a lot of things here and I'll just kind of go through like what I try and do.
Yeah.
In a day. And I'm not perfect by any means. I'm not saying that what I do is ideal for everyone, but I'll just say that what I do and why. But I also don't want people to, you know, I'm going to list these things and it, for some people, it may sound like overwhelming. Like, how could I ever do all those things in a day with what I already do, you know? And the point is not for it to be overwhelming.
Yeah. And but, you study this stuff as well. You're like on the extreme end. Like
and your I didn't.
Book's really successful and highly regarded. Like,
yeah. And I didn't wake up one day and say, I'm going to do all this stuff. You know, it was gradual. So I don't expect people to wake up tomorrow after they hear this and be like, I'm going to do all this stuff. Yeah. You know?
But if any people are listening and they just kind of think like, oh, that would be awesome. Like, and it relates to you and you could find it really easy to do, give it a try.
Yeah, definitely. Just add it to your routine. And then, you know, maybe a few months from now you add something else and pretty soon you're on your way, you know?
Yeah.
So the first thing I do when I open my eyes is do Wim Hof breathing. So it's just, you know, following that, it takes about 15, 20 minutes to do it. And that is something that I have noticed to me is one of the few things I've noticed that affects my heart rate variability the most, which is huge, which is the measure in your stress response. So I do that and then I roll over and I grab my little notebook and I write down what I'm grateful for, in a notebook. And I write that every day. And it usually has to do with what I have planned for the day and why I'm grateful that I have those opportunities for that for the day. I get up and I take my supplements in the morning. I take some magnesium. I take some heart supporting supplements, like some amino acids, like arginine and stuff like that. What else do I take? I take berberine.
Me too. I've been on the berberine train recently and loving it.
I like it. Well, I'm type 1 diabetic, so it's really helpful for blood sugar stuff. Mm. So yeah, I take that, and I take, what else do I take? I take liposomal glutathione. And then I don't eat in the mornings. I just take the supplements. And then I take a cold shower, which may sound awful to people, but it's part of the Wim Hof thing. And again, it's when I started doing that combined with the breathing is when I noticed the most difference in my heart rate variability. So that's the morning. And then I drive to work. Work, I'm a chiropractor. I interact with people. I treat mainly neuromusculoskeletal conditions. So it may just sound like, oh, I go to work and I do a shift. But the important thing there is that I'm fortunate that I get to talk to people all day long, you know, because that social aspect is incredibly important for humans. And I'm not really the most social person. I wouldn't call myself extroverted or a social butterfly or anything like that. But, you know, my job gets me out there talking to people and caring for them. And I feel like that I'm really lucky that I get to do that because that's really beneficial to my health. Then on full days, which are Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you know, we have a lunchtime and I'm usually reading in the sauna and while I eat my lunch. or sometimes I'll sit instead of in the sauna, like in the summer, I'll sit like outside in the sun, like barefoot and stuff like that. While I read, if I don't get too sweaty, cause I have to go back to work after that. I come home and I, after work and I eat my second meal of the day. Usually a little bit lighter cause I don't like to eat too much before I go to bed, or too big of a meal. For me, that's because of type 1 diabetes and like I'm having to gauge insulin levels and or blood sugar levels and how much insulin to give. And so the more I eat in the evenings, the harder it is to gauge how much to give myself throughout the night and everything. So it's generally a smaller meal in the evenings. And then I just kind of hang out and read or hang out with my wife or something in the evenings and we talk. And those are the things I try and get done every single day.
Smash a steak.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, so yeah. I try and go to bed about the same time, maintain that circadian rhythm. I mean, there's way more I think I could add to that, but that seems to be working well for me right now.
Yeah. That's like really good, especially as like a baseline. And that's a lot of stuff, man. That's a lot of things that you're like mindful of and that you're really aware of and that you intentionally do throughout the day, which I think is fantastic. Also, I'd love to start talking about like your thoughts on stress and emotions and how they also affect the heart and how you can sort of gain control over those things to influence your heart and heart health as best as possible.
Yeah. This is a huge topic that I think is overlooked. And it's become one of my missions to talk more about this and get this information out there. Because when you talk about like heart disease, it's always cholesterol, diet, that kind of stuff. And that's important, you know, like diet is important when it comes to heart disease. But I think it's kind of a second to the autonomic nervous system and our stress response. So our autonomic nervous system is the system in our body that's interpreting our environment through our senses and basically telling our body if we're in a safe or threatening environment. If we're in a safe environment, then our body does things like relax, it can sleep, it can digest, it can do things like that, detoxify. If it tells us we're in a stressful situation, then it has the appropriate response to get away from that stress or fight it off or whatever. And so then we're mobilizing blood to our muscles, we're dilating our eyes, we're getting ready to fend off that stress. And so the funny thing is that in nature, animals, you know, they're in a non-stress state, but if they encounter a stress state, they have the stress response. If they happen to get away from the stress, like if they survive the, you know, the cheetah getting out of the bushes and chasing the zebra or whatever, if they survive, then pretty immediately they go back to the non-stress state. And humans are very different. We're the only species that, you know, can literally think our way into a stress response, even if nothing around us stressful is happening to us. Right. So you know, we could see something stressful happen to somebody across the world on the news and be scared it's going to happen to us. Or we can have something stressful happen actually to us. And instead of shutting down the stress response after it's gone, think about it for a month or 2 months or fear it's going to happen again, right? And we can perpetuate this and keep ourselves in the stress response. And that's not good because then we don't have this balance between the two states of our nervous system. And we talk about them like they're, you can be in one state or the other, but really the body is signaling both of them at the same time. And the bad thing that happens if we get stuck in a stress response is the non-stress signal actually gets lowered. We call it decreased vagal tone. And then the stress response becomes more dominant. And then our body's always in this stressful state. So if you think about it, if your body constantly but incorrectly is thinking that you're in a stressed state or you're in a stressful situation, you're not thinking about sleeping. You're not thinking about procreating. You're not thinking about digestion or detoxification. And so people who have this imbalance in the autonomic nervous system tend to have insomnia and sexual dysfunction and digestive issues and detoxification issues and that kind of stuff, because that stuff's never turned on. So this is really relevant to the heart, though, because, you know, there's a reason. You know, most people would accept and understand that there's this emotional connection to our heart. We say things like, I love you with all my heart, or I gave it all my heart. There's this emotional connection to that organ. And it's very well innervated, as all our organs are, but this is very well innervated specifically by our autonomic nervous system. Because it's almost, and actually the nerves that connect our heart and our brain, there's actually more signaling from the heart to the brain. Same from the gut to the brain, because these are the organs that are cluing into our body, you know, our emotional state. And so based on our emotional state, then our brain reacts accordingly. Are we going to cry? Are we going to laugh? Whatever. And so because the heart is so tied to our emotional state, our emotional state has a very big impact on how healthy our heart is. And so, the research is full of all the evidence that shows that, you know, heart rate variability, which is the best measure of balance in our autonomic nervous system that we have, is extremely, or I guess low heart rate variability is extremely linked to poor outcomes for heart health, whether it's heart failure, preventing or predicting heart attacks, high blood pressure, that kind of stuff. It becomes really important to pay attention to that more than just, you know, because every time you hear about like, how do you prevent heart disease? It's always like, at least in the conventional, government organizations and academic institutions are always like, eat less saturated fat, exercise, whatever else, and manage your stress. It's like always the end, you know, it's always like the tail end of things, but it's like, I think it should be first. And when you look at the world we live in today and how incompatible it is with a normal stress response, like all the things that we deal with today that we never really would have had to deal with before, then it's no wonder that we're in this huge, this epidemic of heart disease that we're seeing. That's in a nutshell, I guess, what the autonomic nervous system stress and how it affects the heart.
Oh, 100%. And what are some of the things that obviously, because in terms of de-stressing, or it's even like getting in touch with your emotions, right? Like, what would you suggest people actually do in regards to allow themselves to calm down? Obviously, Wim Hof breathing is something that's going to help you.
Yeah.
And that's one example. Yeah. What are some others?
So just like, you know, we mentioned earlier, just like, I would never recommend someone take a ton of supplements if they weren't going to change their diet. Mm. You know, if they were just going to eat a terrible diet, the supplements probably aren't going to do you much good, or at least not as much good as they could if you change your diet. Same kind of thing here is that I could tell you to do all these different things that have been shown to improve your heart rate variability and lower your stress. But if you don't find the things that are actually stressing you out and work to mitigate them or remove them if you can, then you're just, you know, putting out the fire without catching the arsonist, you know? And so that's the first thing I'd say, is try to identify the things in your life that have the most impact on you stress-wise, which it can be difficult. And sometimes you're going to find out that those things you can't get rid of. Maybe it's that job that you need, or maybe it's your kids. You can't get rid of them, you know, like, and so it, then it becomes changing your perspective of those things. Yeah. Yeah. And how you view them, but then also sometimes, and I've worked with clients on this, sometimes it's more you than it is the thing that's stressing you out.
Every time.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like, so I had a client one time that was, you know, her kids really stressed her out. And I said, okay, well, next time, and I'm not like any like therapist or anything like that. I was just like, well, next time think about what you said to them first, or how you presented to them, or whatever. And she realized that her initial, you know, feedback or response to them was arming them. So then now they're armed and they're going to come back at her. And then she was like, why are you doing that? And it's just like, so then she started to work on changing how she approached them or whatever. And it totally changed the whole situation most of the time. Right. So there's that. And that was just a little tangent or whatever, but,
that's true. My sister,
one thing that,
Yeah,
no, one thing that I came across, not too long ago, was a study that where they looked at the effects of stress on different people within a company, right? And they expected to find that the people with the most responsibility and the higher end, high demand, high stress jobs were going to have the most negative effects to their health, right? Specifically, this study was looking at atherosclerosis, right? And so they're looking at the CEOs, the people with all the responsibility, and they found that those people had the least effects on their health. They were, you know, they were in, because they were in control. They had the power, they had the responsibility. They had a lot of stress, yeah, and high demand jobs, but they were in control. And it was the people lower down in the company that, you know, didn't have quite as much job security, or didn't have predictable work hours, or predictable salary or things like that. Those people were the ones that had the highest stress. So the moral of the story there is that if you can identify stresses in your life that make you feel like you don't have control, or they give you a lack of predictability and it's hard to anticipate things like that, those are the stresses you want to work to mitigate the most, because those have been shown in research to have the most detrimental effect on your health.
Crazy. And I think one of the main things that like people can do that is actually have some sort of like spiritual practice, or take some time for themselves to, you know, either meditate or get some stillness. Like, because I coach entrepreneurs and like high performers, I created this like diagram that had this, it's sort of like an energy wheel I like to use. I use a lot of wheels in like my diagrams, and in terms of just like getting balance between your mind and your body, it's sort of like, you know, your parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous state. I think one of the most important things, which is overlooked now, especially in like 2021, is just like stillness and self-control. And if you firstly take time to take some stillness within your day, it could be a small amount, like a real small amount, it allows you just to like clear your mind and think about all the things that you need to think about. Sort of like you spread them all over the table, and then you sort of dissect and make them a whole lot smaller. And then you sort of be able to, because you have that stillness, just think about all the things that you need to have a little bit of control with. And just for the people that like I've been working with, and the people that I coach, as soon as they add that in, it's, and they can stick to that either consistently on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis. And it's like, depending obviously, because how much they have, they need a little bit more. But it just has like these awesome results that you can see. And I've used it myself when I track things for like my heart rate variability, that when I spend half an hour to an hour a day just with complete stillness, which is sometimes so hard to do, to like book it in and be like, no, I'm just going to take this. Everything feels so much better. The stress goes way down. I make way better decisions and end up being like way more productive with everything that I'm doing, which I find is like fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's totally true. If you take that time to clear your mind, to slow your mind, to calm your mind, you're going to be way more productive when you do have to be, you know?
Yeah. And I just have a theory. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. You may know some research, you may not. And mine is, I think that we sort of, after reading the book Deep Work by Cal Newport, I read that, and just attending a couple of courses on health and heart rate variability, was just, this had the own click in my own mind. I'd just love to hear your thoughts. There may not be nothing on it, just a theory that I've had. And essentially it's like, we need to have a certain amount of stillness within our just lifestyle. And whether that be daily, weekly, monthly, 6 monthly, whatever it is we sort of have a tank of it. And if we're not getting that stillness in throughout like our day, it'll just back up. So for example, it may, and I believe everyone has different tolerances. And I believe, like, let's say for one person, like, it could be something around like having half an hour of stillness a day. Well, if you don't get that from Monday to Friday, then Sunday, you need to spend half the day chilling. If you are all go for a month, then you may need the weekend to just do nothing, or 3 days, like public holiday, come at us. Or like if you don't do it throughout an entire year, it's when people take holidays, they'll take their full 6 to 4 weeks off and just do nothing for 4 to 6 weeks. Feel like don't do anything productive, but they come back and, oh, I feel so much better. Then they have to wait a whole nother year before they can take like their holidays again. And like, I just have the theory that if you don't do this within a certain period of time, your body sort of will shut you down, make you get sick, or intentionally make you feel terrible so that you take time to have stillness to actually recover itself, because it's like, oh, I'm better now. Just to like get rid of stress. That's a theory that I've been playing with. What are your thoughts on that?
And I like it. You know, it's a good kind of framework, I guess, for people to use to make sure they get that in, you know? And I do think you're right. Like, you know, when we get that imbalance in the autonomic system, lots of times we get like in this hyper-stress state, and all of a sudden we get fatigued, or we get like this shutdown. And that's, we need to listen to that. That's your body saying, hey, we gotta shut this down for a while, right? It's so simple, you know, to just listen to your body a little bit, you know, just like if you think you hear, like you, let's say you hear someone in a podcast or you read a book or something like that, and there's this new diet, you want to try it, you try the diet and you've been doing it for a few months and it just sucks. You can't do it. You're like, this is not, or even your health gets worse or something. People are like, but I read the book and it says that it's better for you. So I know it's been, they keep trying to do it. It's like, well, maybe we should listen to our body a little bit and maybe this isn't the right diet for us, you know, or something like that. So it's just listen to your body. And then, you know, I think that, have you ever heard of the idea of dopamine fasting?
No, I haven't. I'm super intrigued, man. I'm super intrigued.
Yeah. So like dopamine is like the feel good, you know, hormone that's secreted. Like, so anytime you do something like, you know, even like writing something down on a checklist and then checking it off gives you a little dopamine release. That makes you a little
putting
surge.
Putting a post
like,
up on social media.
Yeah. You're like, yeah, great. You know, like I did something, or even just looking
achieving
at social
a business
media.
Goal. Yeah.
Even looking at social media and seeing the little likes and the comments and everything like that. Like, yeah. It can be as simple as that, or it can be as
making a sale.
It could be anything like that. But the issue is that there's too much of it, and that we get addicted to these dopamine hits, you know, so that we have to have them all the time. So when we sit and do nothing, we can't. And people, you know, there's like the studies that show that people reach for their phones like a million times a day or whatever it is, you know, because we need that dopamine. We're addicted to that dopamine hit. And so a really good thing that I heard, it's not my idea, but I heard from somebody else. It's called dopamine fasting. And it's kind of what you were talking about, where like, if you didn't do any stillness or whatever you want to call it during the week, you're going to have to take half of Saturday or half of Sunday and just sit and, you know, no dopamine stimulus whatsoever, which is really, really hard to do. That means like no talking to people. It means like no phone, no movies, no reading, because that could, you know, stimulate dopamine. So that's really hard to do, but it could be an amazing reset to get you off this addictive dopamine hit that we, you know, that society around us has addicted to, you know, like the notifications on the phone, the email. Oh yeah, I got to check it, you know, and it's just, it could be really, really useful. But if you did it in small amounts throughout the week, you wouldn't have to take, you know, half the weekend to detox from that dopamine hit, or those dopamine hits.
Dude, that is crazy. I love that. I'm going to look into that a little bit more, dopamine fasting. I really like that. What are some things that you have like researched yourself that you have used and implemented that you think is like some of the best tools or researches that you've actually developed, created or researched and been like, this is the best. I really want to share this.
Well, I mean, I guess a big thing for me, was what my first book is about, which my first book is called The Health Evolution. And for me, it was just, you know, from a very young age, I had a lot of chronic illnesses and things, and I've since gotten rid of most of those. And I did that through, like, you know, trial and error, like lifestyle type stuff. But it wasn't until I really understood, like, evolution, and I always look at things from an evolutionary perspective, that I started, you know, to get the answers as to why I was sick in the first place. And so one thing I really like to share, which is why I wrote the first book about it, was that, you know, these principles of evolution that I think that enlightened me and gave me understanding as to why I was sick as a child and why humanity is sick today. And so, you know, looking at things from an evolutionary perspective, like, the environment that we live in today is drastically different than the one that humans evolved in for hundreds of thousands of years. You know, if you want to take modern humans, you know, that have been around for 200, 300,000 years, that's a long time. But even before that, mechanisms in our body were evolving, you know, before modern humans even existed, you know, and those mechanisms are still consistent. So it's a very long time. And then, you know, since about maybe somewhere between 10 to 15,000 years ago, which sounds like a long time, but evolutionarily, it's not a very long time. You know, our lives dramatically changed. And that was with the advent of, the use of, you know, a crop culture of agriculture, which allowed us to settle down in cities. And that totally changed the nomadic lifestyle that we were living. Now we stayed in one place in close quarters with animals and other people. And it's just so many things change in such a quick amount of time. There's no way that evolution could have taken place to adapt us to those changes fully. There has been some adaptation, but when I think about why we're having such a bad response to the modern world we're living in, it's because there's no way we could have adapted to the changes we've made. So there was some really interesting research done by a Russian scientist in Siberia, where he started selectively breeding these Arctic foxes. And he would look for the ones that had more docile traits, and he would only let them breed. And so he did that generation after generation after generation. And when he got to about 30 generations, he basically had dogs, these foxes that were like dogs. They would come up to him and he would pet them. He would feed them, and they were basically his pets, you know? So that suggests that, you know, we need, you know, at least 30 generations to have, you know, significant change. But that was very controlled, selected breeding, you know? I think it was 30 generations just to start to see traits change. Like, the ears and the foxes were up like this because they were living in the wild and they needed to hear what was around them to survive. And the ears started drooping because they didn't need that anymore. And the color of the coat started to change. But by that scientist has since died, by the 50th generation of this experiment, because people, like, you know, kept doing the experiments after this guy died. That's when they had dogs. So that's 50 generations. So if you think about that, that is a long time, especially in humans, because foxes breed quicker, way quicker than humans do. They have a gestation cycle that's shorter. So that's way too long for us to have adapted to the changes that we see. And the changes keep getting faster and faster and faster, right? Because, you know, maybe 100 years ago, most people were probably farming, you know, and a very different lifestyle. Whereas today, most people are sitting behind desks, like I'm doing right now, right? For most of the day, that's our work has changed. And that's just one of the changes that's happened. So I like to illustrate that to people. I like people to understand that, because to me, it gave me a lot of answers and understanding. So I hope it does the same for other people.
Just like how important your environment is in terms of, yeah, like, your house setup, how you're living, what you're using for cooking, cleaning, how you actually do it, how much time you're spending outside, and being aware of all of those things.
Yeah. And because, you know, when I would tell people, like, you know, you got to do this, you got to do that, you got to avoid toxins, you got to eat this way, whatever, they're just like, why do I have to do all this stuff? Nobody else does all this. So, like, society, that's not normal in society. And you have to realize that the society is not what's normal when it comes to our physiology. Like, what we're doing in society today, lots of things are not normal. And I'm not saying that people should leave society and go live out in the woods or something like that. That's not realistic either.
You just change your environment a bit.
Yeah, just look into your environment, into your modern day environment, and make it more like it would be in so, like, you know, light, for example, you know, when the sun goes down, you know, use less light around the house so that your body starts to get prepared for sleep. Even using red light would be like optimal, you know?
I'm going to buy some more salt lamps today because I've just moved into my house. And like literally I keep writing notes of stuff that I need and taking it off. But one of the most important things, I was like, I need some more salt lamps in here because at nighttime I keep turning the light on and I'm like,
yeah, exactly. And your body's getting triggers to stay awake. And then that messes with your sleep cycle. So it's just like all those little things you got to think about. And, you know, especially for people who, you know, have to wake up in the morning and perform at a high level at their job or whatever, like all these things may seem trivial. Like there's no way I could do all this within my day, but it's just like, if you made these small changes and you made them part of your routine, imagine how much more of a high performer you would be, you know, when you need to be, you know?
Yeah. And it's also really hard to convince people not to do stuff because you get really set in your ways. And when you have to change not to do something because you're so stuck to doing something, it's really hard to do. And I find it's a lot easier to get people to do and try new things. But however, it's this education and awareness of stuff, which is, I believe, when people really understand is when they actually start to make the decision to be like, well, I'm probably going to move this or I'm probably going to throw this out.
Yeah, it's understanding. It's really, really important. So like when I coach people, like I want them to understand why they're doing it. I don't just say, go do these things. We'll meet back in 2 weeks. You know, like I talk to them and say, this is why you're doing this. You understand that? Yeah. Because if they understand it, they're going to continue with it more, you know, rather than just try it for a few weeks and then forget why they're doing it and then stop.
Yeah. All right. So for someone who is sort of at that stage of their life where they've had some success, they've maybe had some financial success, they know where they're going in their life and they've got some things sorted out and they're like, all right, I need a bit of a lifestyle change because I just want to improve the quality of my life to either live a more fulfilling life or to perform at like a higher level. As far as some of the must-dos and the necessities of stuff that people should have, whether it be like as a task going through the house and making sure that they have, you know, eye level lights and darker red lights or getting some sort of sleep tracking software or having regular chiropractic or physio visits or something like that. What do you think, just in your mind, in your perspective, are some of the absolute necessity things that you would encourage people to give a crack at?
Yeah. This is really important. It's really important to realize that, and I'm confronting this now at age 34, that, you know, because in my 20s, you know, and coming out of chiropractic school, I can adjust a million people a day if you want to be, you know, I was just like, you know, and then recently And then recently I was adjusting the same way I've always adjusted. And I got this inflammation in my ribs because of the way I was adjusting. And I was like, man, I'm getting old, you know, like I'm not able to do that anymore.
You're 34, so, man, you're still a baby, Jesus.
I know, right? And I was like, man, and I started to realize that no matter how hard I try, like, your body still does slow down a little bit, you know? And so it's important, you know, you worked really hard, whatever, and got you to that point where you are and you've had the success, you know, in order to maintain that, you got to start watching out for yourself, you know? So this is a really important thing so that you can maintain that high level of success. So I've changed the way I adjust, because I have to, you know, maintain, adjusting people. But I'd say that, you know, my three-pronged approach to not just like heart health, but just like health in general is you want to protect three things. One, you want to protect your metabolic health. That's huge. And so we talked about that, you know, that's, you know, eating that whole food, you know, relatively low carbohydrate, most of your energy from animal fats and prioritized protein diet. That's critical. Because that's linked to so many different, I don't think there's one disease out that doesn't have some aspect of poor metabolic health in it. So that's huge. The second one is make sure you're doing everything you can to decrease oxidative stress or inflammation. And so that's, you know, managing your stress, that's avoiding toxins in your environment, eliminating toxins that may have been put into your environment, like mercury fillings and things like that, you know, that kind of stuff, avoiding. So that, I guess the big five that people are exposed to, like toxins, is like food, water, air, cosmetics, and cleaning products. Like look at those five areas of your life and make sure you're getting the cleanest products. You're avoiding the most toxins as you can. That's huge for oxidative stress, inflammation. And then the third one is, like we've talked about, that spiritual side of things, that emotional side of things. You got to pay attention to that. It's the easiest one to ignore though. But you got to pay attention to that, and you got to keep that side healthy, whatever it may be. For some people, it's religion or prayer or whatever, and that's what they use, and that's what keeps them grounded and keeps them their head, you know, in the right place. You know, other people, it's nature and meditation and things like that, or it's a combination of all those things. You know, like whatever you need to keep your body, you know, or keep your mind, functioning optimally, not getting too stressed out, whether, you know, that stillness you talk about, do that. Those three things, I think, are my main things. I think there's all kinds of other things you can pay attention to, but those things are the most commonly when they get out of balance, are the most common things that lead to dysfunction. That's going to hurt your performance and get you somewhere you don't want to be. So pay attention to those things.
Oh, Stephen, thank you so much for sharing all of that. And thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing all of your wisdom. For anyone who was listening, like, this podcast has been amazing. There was so much in there. I would strongly recommend like writing down some notes or something, because there is a lot to actually go through in there. And I can't wait to listen to it again, because there was definitely parts in here I've just been like, if anyone's watching me or the camera's on me, and I've just like touching my head and being like, because I find it's absolutely fantastic. So if people want to ask you a question or they'd like to follow you and get your books and stuff, where can they find you?
My website is resourceyourhealth.com. My books are there. My blog is there. And I run my coaching through there. My first book, Health Evolution, is on Amazon. So you can find that. The second book we're republishing through a publisher, so it's not available just yet. I'm hoping by early next year. And then I'm on social media a bit reluctantly, but I'm on social media at Dr. Stephen Hussey for Twitter and Facebook and Instagram.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. And thanks for coming onto the show, man, and taking time out of your day to share all this good message and help people to become more aware.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All good.
Thank you so much for getting this far into the podcast. As a token of my appreciation for the loyal listeners, you can get a $50 discount of your first month inside the Set the Standard community. That'll help you double your business and reprogram your mind. We have 2 live group coaching calls per month, 8 modules and challenges, and an exclusive network where you can meet all the men who are setting the standard in here. Please use the code PODCAST, capital PODCAST, to get the first $50 off of your first month. Can't wait to see you guys in there.